Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9
At the races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at the races. About 10 minutes into, let me put my glasses on, 12 minutes into, because I knew it was, I saw there were two digits, but not without my glasses. I couldn't tell you exactly what time it was. But no sooner did we go to the break, and I was telling you that I had a feeling that MIG, you know, Columbia County, I figured MIG knew where we were on Saturday as we went from Hudson to Hartford. And we were just talking off air, and sure enough, let me first of all say good morning, MIG.
Hi, good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Had a crazy, actually, fun weekend doing a bunch of things all day Saturday, and then again on Sunday. But I just was telling everybody how we, you know, we went down to Hudson, to Rock Ridge, to Luray, and saw the Leofric baby, then we started it off to Hartford, and I was thinking of you because we were, you know, traveling that Columbia County route. And I thought to myself, you and I talk about that Hudson Valley, and sure enough, you knew exactly where I was talking about.
Oh, absolutely. Millerton, we always go up to the movies over there. They got the old movie house. It's an old vaudeville house. So you've got one theater downstairs, one theater upstairs, like they made the balcony a separate theater, but it's an old vaudeville house, and they sell like fresh baked cookies and muffins and stuff instead of selling candy. It's like a throwback. You walk down that little main street in Millerton, and you feel like you step back, you know, into the 30s or the 40s. I mean, it's really a quaint little town. And then you were heading through Millerton. If I knew, I would have told you, stop in Sharon, Connecticut. There's a place called Le Gamin, like Gamin, the Philly. A little French spot for lunch. They have a French onion soup that will change your life. I mean, it's haunting. It's so good. This is my area. This is, you know, like, I don't know how many people really understand how cool a Hudson Valley is. There's just so many little nooks and crannies of it and, you know, cool places to see, to eat, the history of it. Like, when you're in Millerton, you're 10 minutes away from where John Morrison had his big bare knuckle match with Yankee Sullivan, which he won in like the 36th round.
Too cool. That the Millerton side, the New York side. I've never gone from, let's say, the Taconic, essentially, in that direction from the Connecticut border. Because Lakeville is right on the Connecticut border, and Salisbury, and what you're talking, Sharon's further, a little further south, down toward Millbrook, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, so, yeah. I mean, I go up through Millerton because I go to the Agway over there. I don't know if you saw the Agway on 22.
I think I did.
Yeah. So, you know, that's when I go up to Millerton, and sometimes I'll shoot across through Millerton. And also, like yesterday, I went to Great Barrington. So I went right through there because I went up to Guido's Market. I had to do some cooking yesterday. It's like basically my last Sunday off until you know, Aqueduct starts again next year, you know, next fall.
Well, that and I saw, I did see that you made that note that you were going up to Barrington, and I would love going there too, south of Lee and up on the Mass Pike. That whole corridor, and even actually even up to the Vermont border, that whole corridor is way underappreciated.
Oh yeah, it's great. Then you've got the Red Lion Inn up there in Stockbridge.
Yep.
You know, I mean, it's really cool. I mean, I love getting, sometimes I'll just get in the car and wander, and you know, you bump into cool things. And like I said, I also love the history of like all New York State. Like we were talking about my friend Robert's play Small over in Stony Point, all of the history there with the Revolutionary War. And by the way, I got a lot of nice notes from people that actually went to the performances.
Yep.
So, you know, it's really cool. And we were actually talking last night, Robert and I were talking and hoping to get him to do some performances in Saratoga if we could find the proper venue.
Well, that's a great idea. The proper venue, I mean, I've discussed this with Brian Bouye, and that's who to start with. You could do it at the Hall of Fame. And I've talked to him about bringing in screenings of films, you know, that, they could be theatrical, they could be documentary. There's that documentary about that I'm imagining most people in the Northeast have not seen, The Last Train to Bay Meadows, which it is spectacular. And I've talked to Brian about this, doing some, I've talked about it and had ideas to do readings, dramatic readings, having a handful of people up on stage and you know, doing essentially, you know, a radio play of Damon Runyon. I mean, people, you know, there's people that are looking for things to do on Mondays and Tuesdays now, on dark days.
I you know what? I got to talk to him. I think that's the great idea. I didn't even think of that. I was thinking maybe reaching out to Boyd with the phasing. They could do like almost like a theater
in the round. Yeah.
But I, you know, I think it would be brilliant. It's really, you know, pretty amazing, this whole part of New York that I you know, you talk to people that aren't New Yorkers and they don't understand that it's not Manhattan. It's not just, you know, Brooklyn, and it's there's just so much to the state. Blessed to live here.
No, this whole, you know, that whole region, they go all the way up through Vermont and, you know, as somebody who grew up, you know, first on the island and then, you know, and then really my formative years in Connecticut. And, you know,
what part of Long Island? I didn't know that.
Great Neck.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. We're Great Neck till
I had no idea.
Yeah. Until I was about six. And although my dad worked in Manchester, construction at a Green Manor Construction, later First Hartford. And so he would be up there and eventually we had a house, we got a little house in Green Manor, which certainly people from the area know the name Green Manor. But then, you know, still had the apartment in Great Neck in the same building as my mother's parents, as Ida and Julius. So, it was like a sitcom, essentially. It was like the Goldbergs, you know, set in Long Island. And eventually, even younger, maybe five, 1964, 65, we were pretty much full time in Manchester. So, but my dad built all over New England. And so I was always, you know, tagging along, and he would go look, you know, he would go check on progress. And it was amazing because we drove through sections. We drove past Torrington, for instance, Torrington, Connecticut. And my dad had built, low-income apartment, 221 D3s, all over New England. And so I we drove Corbin's Corner, for those that know West Farms Mall outside of Farmington, between Farmington and West Hartford. Before there was West Farms Mall, there was Corbin's Corner, which was one of the 50s shopping centers. My dad built that. So I see things. We drive around, and sometimes with Tina, and you know, we'll go past places that, you know, I haven't been since I was, you know, 10, 11, 12, things around Springfield, Mass. And, you know, this is how I know every, you know, every hot dog stand and every ice cream stand in, you know,
that's cool.
in 33 states. Cause I'm like you, I'd love to, you know, I love to poke around and I'd love to, love so to explore. Yeah, exactly.
And it's, I'm a wanderer. I like to explore, and I've, you know, like I said, I stumbled into all these cool things that, you know, Boston Corners up where that fight took place with John Larson. The reason they had the fight there was bare knuckle boxing had been outlawed downstate, you know, down in the city. And Boston Corners wasn't owned by New York, wasn't owned by Massachusetts, it was like an outlaw area. They used to run, the bootleggers used to run their liquor through there because it was like a sovereignty. Nobody had jurisdiction over it.
How about that?
Yeah, so people came up, and there was a train that used to run near there. And like the story of there was like one tavern and 3,000 people just like descended upon Boston Corners to see this fight. And Yankee Sullivan actually thought he had knocked John Morrison out in the 36th round, mind you. They just fought, you know, you pitch till you win, right? And he left the ring. And John Morrison got up, and Yankee Sullivan couldn't get back to the ring in time and got counted out. Yeah, but there's a plaque there and everything. I mean,
I love that.
This is, you know, the stuff that I, this is what we do.
Nice. Yeah. No, I love it. It's tremendous. And I wasn't aware of that. And I've got the Morrison book. I've got the one, in fact, the book that Brian Bouye wrote. Brian Bouye, if you had a double mention of Brian Bouye today, you win. cross it off your bingo card. I can't remember because Jamie Nicholson wrote one too. Jamie wrote what, the Notorious John Morrissey? There's two Morrissey books, one by Brian and one by Jamie. Yeah. So, all right. Well, this is obviously that we can go. You and I we're very bad with this kind of thing. We could go off.
Right now, people are going, I thought we were going to hear stuff about horses.
No, they're not yet. They're not. A couple of other things. Quickly, you mentioned, and I'm sorry that we didn't get a chance to hook up this weekend to go to the show. But as you say, I also got emails from some people that quickly got tickets and went to see Small, and they raved about it. They were so thrilled to have been alerted to it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's tremendous. I've gotten some emails, you know, on Twitter, people are hitting me up about it. So, you know, I'm really happy. I'm really happy for Robert, you know, because this has been a long, you know, kind of drawn out process. But for him to, you know, finally start getting, I think, the notoriety that this always deserved, I'm just really, really happy and proud of him. I'm hoping that we can do something and get more people to see it because I really think it's worthwhile. You know, Jay Hubdy wrote a really nice article about it. And, you know, like there's things I forget. Like, you know, when I was in Mount Sinai, when I, you know, had the last surgery, I guess I was loopy between the drugs and everything else. But Robert reminded me we had a conversation and how I was saying to him, now I kind of understood more, you know, because there were points like he wrote 7 races. Okay. You know, like life goes on, right? I rode 30,000 races and I was in the hospital bed going, I can't believe I'm never going to do that again. You know, like, and the impact of that. And I completely forgot the conversation, but again, I probably was, you know, I was probably heavily medicated. But you know, there he was like visiting me at the hospital in Manhattan. And, there's a kindred spirit between anybody that endeavors to do something outside the norm, outside the box, right?
Yeah.
Whether it be, you know, a professional athlete or a professional entertainer or, you know, jockey, football, or whatever it is, you I think you approach things differently. You just, the world, you have a different world view, if you will.
Well, exactly. And it's, you know, it's broadening. It's enlightening. That's part of it. Rich, I want you, before I... before we talk about anything that happened on the racetrack, I'm sure that you have got a few minutes to talk about Eddie Brown.
And Eddie was the greatest. I was so sad when I got the news that he passed. he was a racetracker through the core. And I can't tell you some of the conversations we had about when he, the year he came on the track was the year that Native Dancer was a 2-year-old. And him seeing him run in Saratoga and talking about that. You know, Eddie had boxed at one point. He was an amateur boxer, Golden Gloves. Still could see him in the room. Like, if he took up the stance, you knew he was a fighter. You knew he had that, like, just that balance and the way to square up. Just a great guy. Just an amazing gentleman. And you know, like, his wife passed several years ago, and I had gone to the wake. The other day, I went in my closet and I took a coat out that I hadn't worn, obviously, since she passed, because the day I found out that he passed, I put this coat on that I hadn't worn, and in the inside pocket was the mask card from her wake.
Oh, my God. Crazy.
And literally 2 hours later, I got the phone call from Harry Rice. I had read something, and then I texted Harry Rice, and Harry reached out to me and told me everything. But I mean, what's the, like, the odds of that? Like,
wow.
I mean, it was very odd, but loved Eddie Brown. You know, he used to make me feel so good because, you know, he also, like, the Terrells and everything, you know, was involved with some of the stagehand stuff. And he would tell me, and it would make me feel so good. He goes, when I watch you finish on a horse, your hand ride, he goes, it's like watching a Broadway production. He goes, you're in such rhythm. And an old timer that had been around and seen all these great riders and worked for great riders, it just made you feel good, you know?
Well, and you know, you're hearing certain things mentioned. He was clerk of scales, right? He was a valet.
He worked the parking lots. Was a valet parker first. He galloped horses in the morning. He worked for Lefty Nickerson, and then he would go and work the parking lot all afternoon until he got the job in the room. I mean, he tells stories of parking guys' cars. You know, big stars. Like, he came up with names and you know, who was a good tipper and you know, who wasn't. But he, like, the names of people. Celebrities that used to come to the races. I wish we would get that back.
The valet for Angel Cordero, Steve Coffin, Jerry Bailey, and Pat Day. Was Pat's valet when Pat won the Belmont on Easy Goer. And I'll put the link up. I did see that, and I'm sure Andy will bring it up tomorrow too. Andy did one of his the Across the Board shows, one of the Across the Board podcast shows that Andy does. They're sort of, you know, haphazard. Andy does them when something interesting bubbles up and he thinks to. You know, he's got time to do it. This one was from 2018, so I'll send the link out to that.
Yeah, you know what? I like them too because it introduces people that the public don't have an opportunity to know.
Right.
You know, you may see a guy walking out with a saddle and putting on a horse or a guy, you know, checking off riders as they go over the scale, but you don't know that guy. You don't know his story. So I really enjoy that Andy, you know, kind of, again, introduce these people to the public because there's so many. You know, there's so many moving parts. There's so many people working behind the scenes to make this happen. I really want to see more stuff done about grooms. You know, the relationship people have with these horses. I've preached this and, I want to be a part of the solution. I want to bring people in. I want them to see the real story, you know, not what people push as their agenda, but what really goes on with the horses and relationships with the people and the horses and how well they're taken care of.
And you mentioned Harry. Harry's listening, and Jose Santos. He says too. He was Jose's valet. In fact, my first awareness that Eddie had passed was on Facebook. That was the first place I saw it, and Jose had a very nice. Tribute to him on Facebook.
Yeah, he had Jose. His I think it was his nephew. I know they were related. Bobby Thibault. We had the bug together, and you know, obviously he worked for him because they were family relation. just a great guy. I remember we all went. It might have been Harry's friends with Teddy Atlas to the Teddy Atlas Foundation, and we all went. Eddie Brown, Harry, myself, a couple other riders, Mike Luzzi, and we went to the bar that Harry works at. It's got the greatest pizza, Lee's, over in Staten Island. Before we went to the event, I'm sure Eddie was with us that night. He's just an amazing guy, really, really a wonderful person.
Eddie Brown, and because I know that Naira had done a nice, they had sent out a very nice tribute piece, and he would apparently regale everybody about Boots Malone, which is also Hammer's, because I know Hammer's listening. That's
best
also
racing movie ever made. Well, that's, hands down.
And here you are too, and Hammer says the same thing about Boots Malone. With, of course, with
not even close. They hit it out of the park with the depicting what it's like a kid coming around, and you know, you're doing every lowly job, and there's reasons behind it. It's a little bit like Mr. Miyagi, wax on, wax off, to build your muscles, to get you, fitter, stronger. And what was impressive was William Holden did all his own riding in that. He could ride. I mean, he could really ride. And then, because he was teaching the apprentice. And Karen Johnson talks about her dad, PG, had some horses in some of the scenes that I guess they, would like rent out some racehorses, and good way to make a day's pay. I mean, I know they did that with Seabiscuit too, and I think PG was just starting out then, but you've seen it, right, Steve?
I have not seen it.
Oh, well, all right. Here's to you and to... It's on YouTube, the entire movie.
Oh, is it really? That I didn't... I guess I can project it. Now I can project it now. I can do it on the screen. That's true. All right.
No, it's right. On YouTube. You got to see it. I
know.
I love that movie.
And I love Holden. I mean, Bill Holden's one of my absolute favorites from...
Michael Hush, and I turned him on to it, and he wound up finding copies, like DVD copies, online, and was giving them out as gifts for a while. I mean, it's a fantastic movie.
I love it. Well, and of course, I was not watching live. I saw everything that went on last night. But you had the greatest tweet, I think, that anybody can appreciate, that you watched you watched the Sabres Rangers game and you watched the Oscars. Those were the two things you watched. And there was a fight, but it wasn't in the Ranger Sabre game.
What's the odds of that? You turn out, watch a hockey game, good, hard-fought game.
Yeah,
Buffalo,
good game.
Buffalo
very
had
good
the
game.
Rangers on the ropes. They came back. They won it. All right, let's flip over to the Oscars, although admittedly I have not seen any movies. And but, you're always interested. And what went on was shocking.
It's crazy.
The crazy thing is, too, so I watched it over because they kind of chopped it up on network, but that's on YouTube also. Will Smith was actually laughing at the joke that Chris Rock said, and his wife was unhappy. And then he must have looked over like, oops, and to walk up and smack the guy. I mean, come on. It was ridiculous. Somebody else tweeted out, I think Bill Gottemer, that would have he gotten out of his seat if that was The Rock up there?
Well, there's actually been, whatever you think of either and the whole incident, it instantly has done is created just a million directions of funny, of funny things. I saw somebody, Samuel Jackson, and of course, minutes later, not long thereafter, Smith ends up winning himself a Best Actor Oscar, and Samuel Jackson gives him a big hug, and somebody writes, Samuel Jackson hugs Will Smith like he's been wanting to slap Chris Rock for years. Apparently that's a gag in itself. I mean, there's been a lot of funny. There's already a lot of funny things that.
We can take humor out of it, but that was bad. It was just such poor reaction by him. Listen, he's a comedian. He made a joke. Was it the best joke? No. Maybe there's certain things you shouldn't. But
didn't listen. Didn't hear it.
Yeah, you don't go hit a guy. I mean, it reminded me of, because like you're in a position, right? if like Chris Rock, who I think handled it as well as it could have been handled. Like, you could see he was in shock, right? But remember, there was a time, Deion Sanders, there was some analyst who questioned his commitment to his team because he played baseball that day and then was going to play football the same day or the next. I don't know. It was one of those things. Well, he played baseball and then he came in to play football. And in the locker room, he like threw a whole bucket of Gatorade on the guy and like basically got in his face. I forget who the analyst was, but that guy can't respond. I mean, first of all, Deion Sanders was an incredible athlete who would have, if they engaged physically, he's probably going to hurt the guy, right? But you've got a job to do. 2 years ago, there was some riders chirping at me because I was critical of a ride in the jocks room. And I'm looking at the guy like, really? I say 100 nice things and criticism with reason.
Well, sure.
Not,
yeah.
Right? And chirping at me. And I'm looking at this guy going, first of all, we're not even in the same weight league anymore. Okay. Like, when you're a jockey, you're all fighting in the same, flyweight 112, 115, but now, like, kid, please, you didn't want any part of me when I was 112. You don't want any part of me at 145. But you can't, because look, I love my job. I get paid to talk about horses. I'm a blessed guy. Like, you're being disrespectful to me, and there's a part of me that I have an ego that would love to go, listen, come here, and just wring his neck. And then I think it was Johnny Velasquez kind of grabbed the kid and said, hey, you need to walk away from this. You're making a big mistake. And I couldn't or wouldn't do anything. It wouldn't have been fair, but I also want to lose my job. So, Chris Rock's up there, and he's paid to do that and gets slapped, and he can't even respond if he wanted to.
Well, it's funny the way you frame that, too, because, Andy, I discuss this with Andy all the time. I mean, he gets amused at this point, discussing jockey's rides, and, he can be complimentary 36 straight times, and the one time he questions a decision or the rider gets all upset, and it's funny. You got to be,
yeah, but it's funny because I've been on both sides of it,
and I know
like if I knew then what I know now, I would have been less sensitive. I think riders in general tend to be a little too sensitive. I can't remember names, but a young lady that worked for the NYRA press department, and she kept misquoting me. Like, I would say something about a horse or a race, and then when I would read the quote, it wasn't what I said. So I made a decision I wasn't going to speak to her, and like I literally one day walked by her and when she was trying to get, post-race quotes, and I just blew her off completely. It was not the right thing to do. There's a better way to handle it, obviously. And she just made up something and put it in the notes. I didn't talk to her. I walked away from her, and I lost my mind, like I was stupid. And you know what? There was a lot of fallout, like, on me for, like, taking that stand with, now I ain't talking to the press. And, again, did I handle it properly? No, but, there's two sides to it, too, But it's funny how you hear the compliments and you don't hear, you don't hear the compliments, but you hear the negative, and listen, a rider is a public game. You're fair game. You're out there. You're not doing your job anonymously. One thing about being an athlete in New York, whether it's a baseball player, football player, hockey player, even a jockey, I would get up in the morning, go to the place where I got my coffee, and the guy behind the counter, hey, Mig, what happened in the third race yesterday? You got trapped, go get my racing form at the candy store. Guy, hey, Mig, what the hell happened? John Pison wrote what happened in the fourth race. You're so center stage. Everybody sees everything.
Sure.
And you got to learn to, let's talk about it. I had a little incident with Eric Cancel a few years ago. He won a race on a Jonathan Shepherd horse, and the horse was rank, running out with him, running off with him, and he got in a big fight with the horse. And I'm on air with Greg Wolf and Paul Aduca and Horse One, and you know, they were both saying what a good ride. And I said, guys, I think our responsibility is to educate. It's not so simple as when a horse wins, it's a good ride. A horse loses, it's a bad ride. You know, we're so result-oriented. I said, this was not a good ride, and I explained why. So the next morning, Eric saw Maggie Wolfendale, who, you know, kind of put a bow on what I said when it went down to her. And the next morning, he saw Maggie, and he, I guess, you know, got silly and said some things to Maggie. So at the production meeting, Maggie told me about it. I went down to the jockey's room, because I think the worst thing we can do as on-air, you know, broadcasters, analysts, is let things fester. So I went down to the room. I asked to see Eric Cancel. He came out from the jock's room, and then when he saw me, he went from being normal to, like, now, you know, a little hoity, you know, chest out. Like, and I said, let's talk about this. I said, first of all, Maggie didn't criticize you. I did. And I stand behind my criticism. I said, the horse broke on top. You reached and got such a strong, well, he was trying to get, I said, he wasn't trying to get out until you grabbed him. I said, so now you can do one of two things. I said, you could be mad at me, and I can live with that. Or you can come to the replay center and maybe learn something. To the kid's credit, we went to the replay center. I pulled up the horse's previous race when Louis Saez rode the horse, and Louis rides with a very long, light rein. Horse went to the lead, threw his ears up, was comfortable, ran straight as a string, won easy. Then I pulled up the replay, which he won the race. Eric, look at the difference. Once the horse opened up two lengths, if you'd have just put your hands down, his ears would have come up, and it wouldn't have been a fight. I said, you guys were working against each other. And I think he learned something from it, and at least he dropped it. But if I had let that go and not gone to speak with him, you know, I'm just the jerk because I criticized him even though he won the race instead of maybe helping him to be a better rider. So I think, you know, we all have to understand we've got to work together. You know, it's not easy being a rider. It's certainly not easy being on air either. People don't realize you got a guy, you know, people in your ear. You got to wrap something up quick because you got to get to something else. And there's a lot going on that people don't see. It's not just you're up there talking as long as you want to talk and say whatever you want to say. You have to, you know, work within this framework, you know, particularly live TV. There's everything's timing. You know, they're going to go to a commercial. You better, you know exactly where you're at in the rundown and where, and also be mindful of the people you work with. You can't just run over them and take all their time. You know, it's a lot of give and take, a lot of interaction.
No, all this is, it's funny that you never know what direction we're going to end up, but that's all well made, points well made, because it for everybody and in each direction, it's funny.
And well, we talk about, like, so did I ever tell you a story? Used to have block party when we lived in Floral Park, and I was riding Meadowlands at night, but I rode all day at Belmont, and I would never go outside to those things, and the kids were young, and Carmel's like, come on, you gotta come out before you leave for the Meadowlands, say hi to the neighbors. And I used to hate that stuff. You know, I couldn't eat. Those guys have had an afternoon off, and you know, they're half in the bag already, and like, you know, my life was not conducive to a social events, right? And so finally she convinced me, because to be a good dad, so I go out there, and a bunch of guys standing around, and I say hi, and I'm like counting the minutes so I can jump in the car and head to the Meadowlands. And one guy says, and basically I've just met these guys, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, the other day I bet on this horse you rode, and you got force Y, whatever it was, you know. And okay, I said, I'm sorry, you know, whatever your name is, what do you do for a living? He said, oh, I'm a plumber. I said, how would you like if I was standing over your shoulder when you were fixing a sink or a toilet, telling you what you did right or wrong, you know? And the guy started laughing. The guy got mad. I was just trying to make a point. Like, dude, we're out here because of the kids. And I got to listen to you critiquing what I do on a 1,000-pound animal. You know, it's like, you know, you can't get away from it sometimes.
No. That's great, though. It's nice that they're watching and paying attention.
True. Yeah, but you know, it's as much as I miss riding, and I always will, it's kind of nice not to live life looking through a keyhole, because, you know, particularly for me, making weight, dealing with my body, fighting injuries, sure, all of that. I lived life looking through a keyhole. It was very, very hard for me to ever relax. It wasn't like, okay, walked out of the jockey's room, leave it there. You know, now I had to figure out exactly what I could eat tonight to be able to make weight tomorrow.
Yep.
My schedule for the morning, I get up, you know, what time I needed to get up, so how much sleep I had to get. And I was one of these guys, like, I got to be in bed by 9. And even if I couldn't sleep, I'm laying there trying to will myself to sleep, which never works. But that's the only way I can describe it, is like living life looking through a keyhole.
Yeah, that's one of the things that you try to drive home, you know, these topics when I talk to you, when we talk to Tony on Thursdays. It's such a unique, so different and unlike, you know, anybody else, anybody else's lifestyle. It's, you know, it's unhealthy, let's be honest. It's dangerous. And then at the same time, you're obligated, you know, essentially you're obligated to, you know, if you're married and have a family, you know, you got to live, you know, a normal social life, as you're hinting. I mean, the demands are so unique.
Well, listen, I was very fortunate. I'm very fortunate to have the wife that I have, because she carried the ball. I mean, you know, she'd take 4 kids to Disney World on her own. Like, you know, and I did get better at it as, you know, the kids were growing up, because, you know, they don't care if you got beat on 5 favorites and you're seeing purple spots from pulling so much weight that they want to catch in the backyard. Dude, Dad, you're not, you know,
yeah,
the meg. You know, so you learn. I had a family member one day. I went to some family thing, and oh, the Meg is Meg. I'm your freaking nephew. Like, you know. No, but you know, you do. You learn to balance it better. But you know, the funny thing is, like, I'll run into people now all the time. I say, man, you look like you could ride. I'm 35 pounds heavier than when I was riding. And so, like, I even look at myself sometimes and go, how the hell did you maintain, you know, basically 112 pounds every single day? Because I wouldn't go up and down. I did that early in my career, and I was no way I was going to be able to have a career. You know, I'd leave the room on Sunday night 112 and show up Wednesday morning 120, and then have to get back. You know, you can't ride that roller coaster. So, you know, I made a decision early on, well, I've just got to maintain it constantly. And other than, like, maybe Christmas, which I've told you I would bother somebody so I would get days, I could relax a day or two.
Well, let's get at least 10 minutes in and talk about a couple of results so that we can say that we did talk some racing. And I had Steve Asmussen on earlier, Rich, and you know, obviously you guys are actually, you know, you're not involved with the fairgrounds feed, but there is those results to discuss. There was that card of the starter, you know, the claiming crown of New York, essentially on Saturday. What do you got?
Yeah, no, it was great day of racing. I was on Saturday. I love the claiming crown. You know, I those horses are the heart and soul of our game. You know, they show up consistently and give it their all. So I love the day to kind of celebrate the lower level horses. And, you know, you look at the names the races are named for. I mean, horses like More to Tell. I mean, the epitome of that warrior, that horse that would show up, you know, every single time. And all of the horses that the races are named for. I tell you the truth, Epicenter did something to me. I think this horse is progression.
Yep.
I think him showing another dimension. You know, we always talk about, what do all good horses have in common? They possess speed. It's how they learn to use that speed which distinguishes them as a racehorse. And the fact that he sat in that pocket so comfortably, in behind horses, took some kickback, looked as professional as a horse could look, and finished the way he did. And what do you want out of a prep race? You of course, you want to win them. They're important races, but you want to win them using it as a building block, not as a you know, something to tear you down. He won with something left. His stride is his mechanics are impeccable. I mean, he really, in the Louisiana Derby, made me see something I hadn't seen previously. Even though, obviously, nice horse, good horse, I think he really went to the head of the class in a resounding way. And, Echo Zulu, I think she's getting, she won and people are knocking her. She's coming off the bench. I think that in some respects, she almost might have went to sleep a little bit on the lead. Like, he had her so switched off. But then when she felt company, she dug back in. I think you'll see more of the Echo Zulu as a two-year-old that you saw. Now, it still remains to be seen if she made another step forward from two to three, that not necessarily that she needs to be certainly at the top of the division, because she was such a brilliant two-year-old. But if she actually made that step, that improvement that they normally make from two to three, I just don't think that people should be as critical of that race as some of the things I've read, particularly on social media.
Well, and I asked Steve specifically, to kind of address it, and he sounded satisfied and confident that she'll get plenty out of it. He said point blank, she was tired. He said she was blowing, and he said she definitely was tired. He said this morning she was, that much better, 48 hours, out of it, out away from it. So they acknowledged it. And to me, it was a sign of enthusiasm and a positive that they went ahead and ran her in this spot. And he drove that point home, Rich, that, to make her career, her seasonal debut in a two turn long stretch mile and a 16th grade two, that was a bit of an ask, really. I mean, she had seven works. She only worked seven times getting ready for the debut.
Well, and I always look at things at, like, what did we learn about a horse? So like, she's been such a dominant horse in all of her races. This is the first time she had a reach down, the first time that she had a horse, basically she had to take a punch, right? And I always, what I like to say, we all know, good horses can throw a punch. What you learn about their tenacity, their desire, their heart, is when they have to take a punch. And to me, I think she answered that question saying, hey, yeah, you know what? When it's not everything my own way, I can find a way. I thought, to me, there was a lot more positives out of the race. Yeah, all right, it wasn't that eye-catching brilliance that, she slapped you in the face with as a two-year-old. But I think there was so many positives out of the race, and the fact that she showed she'd fight for it. Some horses don't fight for it. I've ridden horses that dominated races. You go, man, this is like a really good horse. And the first time they had somebody standing toe to toe with them, what happened? Where was this horse? And it there's a lot to that. People don't understand. Their personalities, their flesh and blood. They're a herd animal. Do they want to be the herd leader? That she answered that question.
Yeah, and the way in which she held off Hidden Connection.
Who's a good filly.
Yeah, who's very solid. And this was the time, this was the opportunity for her. I mean, that was a tough beat, undoubtedly, for those connections, for Brett Calhoun and his team.
Yo, absolutely, yeah. But she ran well. Ray Lou Gutierrez has been riding so well. Jose Santos Jr. has been doing an amazing job with him. And, that lead is quickly, Dylan Davis, leading rider. My brother Michael works for him. Trevor McCarthy, second leading rider at Aqueduct. My son Joseph works for him. And when Ray Lou had the bug, I was in Maryland to cover, I think, the General George, and was talking to him, and he was talking about he wanted to come to New York. And I said, you should take my brother Michael, because one thing that has been drilled into my brother's head and my son's head is a jockey's not just a commodity. He's a person that has a family, has a life, and I've seen too many guys now, particularly in this era where guys are having several jockeys in several different jurisdictions, they're treated like commodities, you know. Okay, well, he's riding good. I can't work for him now because I got this. They're disposable. They throw them away easily. And when a kid has the bug, he needs someone in his corner. He needs someone that's going to pick his head up when it's a bad day, when he's leaving the races, to help him enjoy when it's a good day, to keep him focused and keep his schedule, you know, straight, and to really be a mentor as well. And, you know, like I've talked with Joseph, with Trevor, you know, you got to manage these guys' careers. I go down a rabbit hole. I'll start looking at charts when I'm doing pedigree query, preparing for a show, and say, well, I rode that mare. And I'll go back and I'll look at the Equibase charts, right? Now, Steve, I'm a guy who pulls 3, 4, 5 pounds every day. I rode, oh, let's see, look at that day's charts. I rode every race, 10 races at Saratoga. Okay, this horse was 10-1, but it was for Richie O'Connell. I was my guy. Oh, this horse was 3-1, 5-1, 20-1, but oh, you know, I ride for that guy. Wait, who's this horse? 55-1. I don't even remember this train. Oh, wait, the horse came from Rockingham. I had agents that would throw me on anything. And like, you only have so many calories to work with a day anyway. And you know, I was a guy, I liked to ride. I went out and rode, and by the time I got to the gate, I figured out how that 55-1 shot was going to win. And, you know, most of the time they didn't, but they got an effort. So it wasn't like I was just going around for a ride in Central Park. I was putting the effort in and, you know, talking to Joey, you know, Trevor's like me, he's a taller rider. You know, when they're for customers, you ride whatever they want you to ride. But when it's for people that you don't ride a lot for, if it's a horse that you could pass on, give him a race off. Give him 2 races off. Don't make him ride 10 every day, because at some point, if you – like I could will myself through it physically, but where I would break down would be mentally. And I would say, man, I said things to people about their horses sometimes I'm ashamed to say. I mean, you know, I had one trainer – tell me something, and I said, listen, I have split seconds to make decisions out there. I said, you had a lifetime to eat all them pies and cheeseburgers to get that fat. I mean, I said that to somebody, and that's all mental breakdown. That's not, you know, that because I was just so malnourished. So, you know, having a guy that would, you know, manage your career. And I thought Ray Lou made a mistake. You know, he had a very good agent in New York. I think Jimmy Riccio took him, but Jimmy Riccio had Jose Ortiz, and he was in Florida. He wasn't going to be able to be there kind of holding his hand and guiding him through. And you see what my brother's done with Dylan. It's been a process, but they worked together.
No doubt. And the whole winter, you know, the winter opportunity, and in fact, it does open a slot for me to mention a couple of jockey pieces of news, Rich, that you could even riff on. Ramon Vasquez is going to go to California and seems very clever to, you know, fill a void with what's happening there with Pratt and Rispoli coming east. And then I saw Junior Alvarado is going to go ahead and stay in Florida. Some interesting, you know, maneuvering. But the winter, you know, the winter decisions and coming to New York, you know, to ride for the winter. I mean, the purses obviously are good. So, you know, there's some interesting dynamics. And Trevor, who I think I understood the idea of going out west, but quickly, you know, rebooting and coming into New York, that, you know, that was a better move for him. And I think he's clearly established himself, you know, very, very soundly.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think he had always had that kind of need to give California a try, and he gave it a try. And, you know, it's very difficult there because of the horse population. You know, you're coming into a place that already has 6 or 7 really established riders, and you're the new guy. And if there's only 5 and 6 horse fields, you know, where do you fit in? Where can you slip through the cracks? So, you know, it was difficult for him, but he tried it. And, you know, it's okay to fail. It's okay. You know, things don't go well. To me, the thing that you want to avoid is having regret. Give it a try, you know, take your swing, you know, and he did, and it didn't work out. But, you know, now with Pratt and Rispoli coming to New York, it kind of, like, if he had waited and did it this year, that would have been the move, right? But who knew that? Who knew that these guys now are coming east? And it opens up some spots in guys that are taking live mounts. I like Vasquez. I think he's a good rider. I like his approach. I like his preparation. It's one thing I look at. Guys can win races. It's horse racing. But guys that win races because they prepare and they do their due diligence, those are the guys that I really, gravitate to. And Trevor's one of those guys. He'll win on horses that some other guys won't because he goes the extra bit, and prepares that well. And I see that with Vasquez. I think it's a very smart move for him. One thing, like, winter racing has always been an opportunity for riders to get a shot. But people forget, and I grouse about this, there were winters in New York that the Colony included Jerry Bailey, Eddie Maple, George Velasquez, Angel Cordero, myself, Mike Smith, Jose Santos. Like, I don't want people to get this idea of, well, it's winter racing and you throw it away. You go back and look at the charts, particularly early to mid-80s, and you look at the Colony that we line up here because the purses were so much better than Florida. And other than weekends, it was a lot of Calder-type horses winning the races, and guys weren't going to be riding them. So guys like Angel and Georgie Maple, they got to a point where they'd ride here and fly out for stakes when they had to. So I just get frustrated when people kind of almost throw it away. Like, oh, well, it's winter racing. These guys are good riders, and you ride dealing with the elements. It's a lot harder to ride when it's 20 degrees and that wind's whipping off Jamaica Bay and starting gate's rattling than it is, 70 degrees with a little breeze off of Fort Lauderdale there,
Well, exactly. And it certainly has gotten easier, Rich. It was during your career, there weren't too many cancellations because of the deep frost and the, and nasty conditions. That's a fairly modern, phenomena that's happened. I mean, and people grouse a little bit about it, but I think people have actually, I think they've come to understand these cancellations when the weather sets in.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to, and you got to be thoughtful about it. The other thing too is, I think you don't have as many horses now, even in New York, obviously, it's not just California, but back in the 80s, we raced 6 days a week and they'd be full fields, 10, 12 horses every single race. Not so much now. So if you lose a day here or there, you're just kind of helping your horse population, like, spread it out through the winter. I mean, that's why we have less days. But we would race all the way to Monday and then start on Saratoga on Wednesday and finish in Saratoga on Wednesday and start again at Belmont on Wednesday. Every meet, we only had that one day off. People don't remember that. And then one year, because we did have some cancellations, somebody thought it would be a good idea to run 28 straight days when it was a 24-day meet. We ran 28 straight days, no days off, Monday through Sunday, every week, Tuesday. There were never more fights in the jockey's room between riders, valets, everybody was at each other's throat because all you did was work the entire 28 days.
Well, it probably.
I still get blamed for the cancellations, by the way.
No, I wasn't going to go there.
Listen, Steve, I broke my arm. No, I'm sorry. I broke my leg a week before Thanksgiving. Wound up taking a very good friend of mine, had a home in Celebration, worked for Disney. I went with the kids, took them to Disney World. I'm on crutches. They canceled the Friday after Thanksgiving. So they ran the Thanksgiving Day card, and they had to cancel the Friday card because of it was ice storm or something. I'm in Disney World with my children, and my phone's blowing up. Oh, you freaking did it again. I'm in freaking Disney World.
I was going to completely avoid that. That's so great.
It was no matter what. There were, listen, you'd have 20 guys in the room. The way it works, the guild rep, I was one of the guild reps, would go in the back room if there was a question, and we'd vote. And the majority ruled. That was the way it went. There was one day, me and Aaron Greider, there were 20 guys in the room. Me and him said, guys, It's uncomfortable. It's not unsafe. There's a difference. You know, winter racing is not always going to be comfortable, but it's not unsafe. It's not like we can't perform our job. Me and Aaron, the two Gill reps, voted to ride. 18 other guys voted not to ride. Who got blamed? Me and Aaron, because we go out and inform the stewards, inform the clerk of scales, talk to the press. But you're not going to go, well, wait, I voted to ride, because that's not what you do. It's the majority rules. And because, you know, the way they killed the spokesperson.
I'm going to absolutely avoid this. I'm not following this up, because there's horsemen.
You've heard too many stories.
Heard them all. I've heard the Siaka, and yeah, that's true. Gary, I think, does hold you responsible for 80% of them.
Well, so that one particular incident I'm talking about, we voted the next morning. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. I had to go work a horse for Dutch Row at Aqueduct. It was just as cold the next morning, if not obviously colder. And I walked into the clocker stand because I still had like 15 minutes. I was working the horse at 6. It was like 5:45. And there's a rider in there talking to Juan Saray. I'm not going to get into names here other than Juan Saray. And I walk on him telling him, oh, I wanted to ride. And this was the most vocal guy and not wanting to ride the day before. No, it was Migliori and Grider. They were and I was like, excuse me? And I'm getting ready to fight the guy in the clocker stand. And that day I went to the jockey room. Oh, yeah, because Juan Saray said, yeah, if you don't want to ride, stay home. I said, it's 5:45 in the morning. I'm here to work a horse. I don't want to ride. So I went to the jockey's room that morning, 10:30, called a meeting in the bunk room, and that was the day I said, this is how it goes from now on. If I don't like it, I was at a different stage of my career. If I don't like it, I'll take off and go home. If I like it, I'm riding. I'm not going in any more votes. That was the last vote I ever did. you got me all fired.
I know. You're all right. Exactly. Exactly. All right. Go for a hike. The sun has come out. I see the snow is melting. Did you get snow? We got snow.
Yeah, we got about an inch.
Yeah. Yep. All right.
Yep.
I want to see.
Have a great day.
Too funny.
We're nothing if not entertaining.
Exactly. Rich Migliori, everybody. Mig4450 on your Twitter. There he goes. Let's take a case. You all right for a break? Let's take our other break. And when we come back, we've got Jay Privman in a little bit. Jay's on the backstretch at Oaklawn, so we'll talk to him. We'll get his fairgrounds recapping. And you might have seen his written recap. My guy. We're going to get Joey in here and have a visit with Joe Bianca from TDN. And Joe's this is the second of his better series, Conversations. He's got a visit that he's done with Randy Moss. And I want to let Joe publicize it. I wanted actually to, when he launched it, he did one with David Aragona, and I wanted to get Joey to publicize that one. So I'm not going to miss a chance to have Joe Bianca join us next. Back after this, hour three, a sunny, beautiful Monday, as opposed to the as opposed to having to go out and shovel the stoop and the walk when I woke up this morning. Back after this.
The Ponce Family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic.